You're listening to the Outclassed podcast with Mike Redding and Blake Seifert, exploring excellence in teaching, tech, and leadership.
All right, welcome back to the Outclassed podcast. It's great to be back with you today. For those of you that are watching any of our stuff on video, then you'll see that Blake's in a new venue. It looks quite nice behind you there, Blake.
Absolutely. Schools are back. My home office has been deconstructed. So, we're back on deck at school. We're still in lockdown. Not much has changed except for schooling and a few other industries. But, it's good to be back.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I had a week off last week. I was had a combination of a couple of things, actually. It was a little bit crook, but I was also off getting some awards as well for some of the stuff we've been doing with Microsoft, which was great. But you held the fort. Listen to that podcast that came out last week, just got released at the end of last week, which was really good, where you sat down and you interviewed someone on Christine Jackman on the whole option of, or the whole thing about noise in your environment and how that can affect you and so on. It was a very interesting listen.
And you were away from the noise, Mike, getting some peace and quiet.
Yeah. So, I definitely listened to that while I was on a bit of a break and turning off. It's been interesting listening to a couple of things actually around that, the role that technology plays in terms of always being on, always in your pocket, always being available, and how we just unplug from the world. And it was just very interesting listening to that podcast, how obviously you guys made the connection between what's happening in the workplace and what's happening personally and then what's happening in education, and sort of drew some threads together around not just noise in terms of auditory noise, but in terms of just busyness of life and
noise in your head. Yeah, it's a hard thing to manage, and I'm certainly guilty of it as well. Things creep in, you know, notifications. You say, okay, I'll turn them off, but you add a new app and they're on, you know, and you've got to actively constantly manage this stuff. It's sort of like more micro work for everyone to do.
Yeah, and I thought it was an interesting parallels too between, I wonder what was happening in terms of COVID when you look at people in lockdown and not necessarily in meetings at work, but still everyone, you know, jumped online, and then all of a sudden you've even got more digital noise and you've got more distraction and people just like binging on Netflix and all sorts of things going on. I wonder if anyone really took the time just to you know, break it apart and see what's going on in terms of that noise in the head. It was interesting having a conversation this week with some teenagers too. Now saying, because they've just always got music on, right? They've just always got headphones on, always listening to music. I'm like, why don't you turn that off? And they're like, what? And I have to deal with the voices in my head? No way.
Yeah, unfortunately, if you don't deal with them, they'll find a way of making themselves known, won't they? So, I mean, that's the dichotomy, is we can ignore things and we can, you know, reach for those easy access devices when you're feeling a bit bored or lonely or whatever it is. But if you don't kind of reconcile the underlying issues, you're going to be in for a worse situation later down the track, I think.
Yeah, definitely. So that was episode number 23. If you haven't listened to it, go back and grab a listen. But today we just want to dive in. This is episode 25. So that's a quarter of a century, Blake. Feeling pretty good about that, to be honest.
Yeah, 25. It's good. What's that? Yeah. 25 weeks in a row. We managed to do it. That's good.
That's half a year. Come to think of it, I think I'm ready for retirement.
You just came back from a break. I think you're ready to go. Yeah, speaking of noise in the news this week, Mike, I noticed Google has renamed G Suite to Google Workspace. That's a pretty big one for our show in terms of our listeners. A lot of Google's G Suite users out there. And I remember back in the day it was called Google Apps. Then it went to G Suite, and there was enough backlash about that. Now it's Google Workspace. So I just get amused by the constant renaming of things and how much money that must cost the company.
Yeah. Well, even from our point of view, like all of our stuff, because we're a Google partner, we get to use all their logos. So they just went through updating for like the Google Apps to the G Suite, and then it was Google Cloud. And so every time there's an update, there's a new logo that comes out, and then all of our stuff is then out of date. And then you've got to rethink about what you need to update and what you don't, and say, yeah, here we go, another change, another set of logos. And
yeah, you got to try and remember it all, and that's really challenging because you have all this content out there. You've sent emails, you've sent documents, and where is it all? And that's that's kind of an interesting thought for schools as well. Something I've been kicking around is this idea of like proper content management. So whenever you create a policy or you create a booking form or anything like that that you create inside the school environment, you almost have to have a responsibility attached to that in terms of, did we mention the school name and the logo? And then when the logo is updated, you know all the places where the logo is. Mm. So there are people like in business, like in Google, there would be someone who's managing this so that when they change, you know, the name of Google Apps to G Suite and G Suite to Workspace, that they know everywhere where that exists and can replace it overnight almost, or at least get it ready to be replaced overnight. So that's an interesting thought about, you know, when we put policies up on the website, like who's reviewing those? When are they reviewed? Mm-hmm. What assets are we using in them? School names, principal names, you know, use the principal name and the principal leaves next year. Who's going back and updating all that? It makes you look very sloppy if you're not consistent. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's obviously a big thing. It's a lot of work and effort. Not every school can justify that kind of investment, but mm-hmm. For the schools that can, it's a big challenge. I'm interested to hear if any of our listeners tackle this problem and what they do about it, or whether they just kind of go through with a fine-tooth comb every once in a while.
Mm. Yep, and there's some interesting side effects to that too. Like in New Zealand schools, a lot of the principals all have principal at, not their first name at. And so with that, what that does is it gives you some interesting problems with G Suite, because they might change principals. And maybe the principal will change the name in their email system, but it doesn't force that change into your contacts.
Yeah, my personal contacts. Yeah, that's a problem. Yeah.
Yeah. So you might be emailing using an old name for a principal, or it even comes through as a different name. So we get a bit confused. I've actually got a meeting with a school next week, and I still don't know who I'm meeting, because someone introduced me with a particular name, and then somebody else replied with the same name, but there's two different people, but the same email address, and I'm not convinced who's who in the zoo. So I actually sent an email saying, like, this is a little bit embarrassing, but I've got no idea who I'm meeting when I rock up to reception next week.
And that's the confusion. You know, you want to avoid any sort of confusion like that, especially when you talk, looking from, you know, my perspective with the work I do with school communication, is like the biggest thing you want to do is build trust. And if mm-hmm. things are confusing or don't seem quite right, can undermine that process. And you know, I also see the benefit of having like a principal app, so that you're not having to figure out who the principal is next time and email the new person's email address. But yeah, like you said, there are side effects of personal contact lists and then not knowing who's who, you know, at the moment as the principal in the school. So yeah, it's pros and cons of both. I think I prefer our method where we just use everyone's name, and you know, we can probably still set up forwarders if we had to, but we try as much as possible to link it to the person's name.
Mm. Yeah. So in terms of Workspace rolling out, have you had a chance to have a bit of a look under the hood yet? And have you got any first impressions?
Yeah, well, I mean, this was sort of part of their integrated workspace, they called it a while back. And it's really about bringing together four really important tenets of communication, which is your email, chat rooms, and video conferencing. So with those four things in your email box now, you don't have to leave your email box. I think there's some interesting possibilities, like being able to chat and open a document and edit that document. And you can also be on a meet inside, picture in picture, all inside your email box. So you can be really multitasking, working together collaboratively without having to switch tabs and go back to your video and come back to your chat and then go back to the document. I can really see where they're trying to go with that. And they're launching with other little things, like they're trying to integrate. If you paste a link into a doc, you get it, hover on it, you'll see the document. You'll see when you last opened it, if it's been edited since you opened it. Little things like that, I think, are going to go a long way. Mm. But I think for me, my concern with it is at the moment is the consistency of it. So we open up Google Chat, and in Google Chat, you can do certain things you can't do inside the email box. So you can't search your Google Chat easily. It's not as easy to see how to search it in your email box. You can, but it's not as straightforward. There's certain settings as well you got to go into chat for. So they'll fix these things, you know, but I think at the moment it's just a little inconsistent at times. With how things are displayed and how they work between the two products. So they've still got their dedicated chat and chat rooms product. But it's also integrated in your inbox. So you're kind of thinking, which one should I be using? And definitely on the phone. I know, Mike, you've experienced this, having Gmail notify you, Google Chat notify you, Google Hangouts notify you at the moment until that's shut down. So there's so many places notifying you, and, you know, pop-ups on your desktop. So one message can hit me four times in four different places. And so I've had to manage that. And that's okay for me, but I think for the average person, they just want to know, you know, that's dealt with. And the other thing I don't like as well is when a channel, someone types into a channel and you get a notification, and then they might type subsequent things, like three or four other things to add to what they're saying. They all come through subsequently. And I feel like it should just hit you once, and then, you know, there's something in that channel you haven't read, and you go into it and then you can read the rest. So little tweaks like that, I think, to make it more usable. And again, address that noise issue. I think the biggest challenge you have with chat products, real-time messaging, is squarely around notifications. And how you manage them, how well you manage them. Slack does a really good job of this. And we've actually just migrated from Slack in our team. I haven't told you this yet.
Okay.
Migrated from Slack to Google Chat Rooms because it's integrated now. And I also don't like, you know, this is kind of a philosophical thing, is I don't like using a separate product and asking staff to use a different product when they do the same thing. I don't think that's really a good way to run, you know, to run things. So we are trying to sort of dog food ourselves and use the stuff we're asking other people to use. And we then understand how it works and what the nuances of it are and what the issues are. So when people come to us, we're really well versed in it, even if it does cause us a bit of pain in the short to medium term.
Hmm. How are you finding it setting up all the rooms then? Because you've only got a certain amount of real estate, whereas Slack, you've got a lot more. So
yeah. No, we set them all up. I initially had that concern, but it hasn't been a problem because in your inbox, you don't really manage them. They just, the most recently messaged one goes to the top. If you want to sort of go and dive in, you have to go to Google Chat, and you can start things there and sort of manage it a bit more. But I'm just using the inbox actually, and it's been a lot better. I actually thought it was going to be more painful than it is. And we've done some things to make it a bit better for us. In terms of how the notifications are sent from our automations and things, but that's very much IT team specific. But no, it's been okay. And I think for staff, you know, I can't see a staff member having too many. I think I've got like 16 or 18 or something like that. And that's okay. I wouldn't want too many more, but for the average teacher, you might have a subject specific one. You might be part of an assessment committee. You might be in a faculty and a couple of other things. You might have five, six, seven rooms. That's more than manageable. That'd be great. And the beauty of these rooms is they're so participative. There's no central structure to them. Anyone can add anyone. Anyone can leave. And so that doesn't work well for using it with your classroom, but it does work really well for staff self-moderating, you know, so they can say, I'm no longer part of that faculty. I can leave when I'm ready and rejoin later if I need to come back. So the way they've done it, it's deceptively clever in terms of its simplicity, where it gives you a lot of choice. And it takes away a lot of those administrative controls that you need in Slack and Teams and those other apps, and kind of just leaves it in the hands of the end user. Of course, the negative of that is if everyone's an admin, you can't really have your 30 kids in the classroom in there, because they'll add, remove, you know, do all sorts of tricks on you. So,
yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I was just looking at my phone then, just like working through what's frustrating me about it, especially on the phone, because I use mobile quite a bit. And I can't figure it out. I've set the settings to notify me in chat, but not in email. But it keeps, on the phone, it keeps wanting to push me back to email all the time. And it's just another click, because you've got to open up your emails and you've got to go down to chat down the bottom. You've got to open up from chat down the bottom. Like, it's not. So just, I don't know, it's slowing me down at the moment, which is frustrating.
And it's not clear how to turn those off. I think that's going to come. I mean, they're, like, everyone who works at Google would be having that problem. So I don't see that as being a longer term problem, but it certainly hasn't been the smoothest launch in terms of, yeah, that noise, the notification noise.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. And I think part of the deal for me in terms of that, in terms of unification, I think that's right. I've always said, try and get the most you can out of the tools that you've got. So why would you have this tool and then you're going to like Slack that's doing another thing. So now you're managing two products and then you add another one for some other feature. The more you can put into one tool and the more it keeps you in the one space, it's really good. So from that point of view,
I think so too. And the benefits we've had from that in terms of the really exciting stuff is working remotely. If staff would message us, they get instant support, obviously, but We can include someone in that conversation straight away, you know, have a three, four, five way, you know, chat between the people that needed to know. And also we can drop a meet straight in there. And it's like, oh, we're going to have a proper face-to-face on this. Mm-hmm. Click the meet button and bang, we've both got the meet. So little things like that, that, you know, in Slack, it's like, oh, let me go create a meet, grab the link, come back in, paste it in. You know, that has been just those in, like that integrated side of it. And I think that's where Google want to go with this workspace thing is it's just seamless. Like the way they've got editing documents in line with chat, you can be having a chat on the left in your chat room about your, you know, your little subcommittee group, whatever it is, with the document open, creating the document. I just feel like that's such a compelling way to do things. Mm. One of the downsides I've noticed is it's quite intensive on your computer, having a doc open and chat open, and Gmail, of course, is running in the background as well. It's that one tab is getting hammered. And even on, you know, a decent computer, it runs slow. I'd hate to think how it runs on a, you know, an entry-level machine. So so little things like that they've got to iron out. But overall, I like the strategy. I think they had to do something. You know, we've spoken about this before with Teams and how we were looking at, I was looking at doing Slack, but I was kind of waiting. And this is what we're getting now. So we're going to give this a good go and see if it meets our needs. And how you know, the, often the best litmus test is to see how the organic take-up is within staff. How easily, you know, they adopted and whether they want it or not. So we'll sort of review it in 6 to 12 months and see where we're at. But at the moment, early signs are really good. Small, self-moderated, self-created groups are loving it. You know, groups that you would see sitting in the common room, you know, three people sitting around looking at a document, setting up a SAC, looking at assessment criterias, those kind of teams within teams, this is excellent for. Whether it'll filter up to all staff groups and full KLAs being in there, that's still a question mark that we're looking to explore.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. They have to just start with some of that. Like, this is not a play for education. This is a play for the corporate market, business market. Correct. And generally, the sales prop when you went to G Suite in business, because we do training in both education and business and government, was that, oh, you're trying to disrupt how things are, so let's push a new product and it forces people to collaborate differently, think differently, work differently. So sometimes a CEO wants to shake the culture, they'll bring G Suite in and they'll use that as a lever to do that. And the other one, there was massive cost savings, right? So it was about $5 per user per month for Google in the business at the basic level. Now when you're comparing the price of Google to the price of Microsoft, they're pretty much neck and neck. In fact, in some areas, Google's even more expensive than what you get with Microsoft. So they've removed that, the cheaper, nastier, more simplified kind of branding, I guess, if you want to put it that way, to coming out and saying, like, we want to be a fully fledged business word processing suite of tools. Yeah, so... You have to see this moving forward.
They're still, I noticed in their marketing, they're really still pushing like the simplest option. And and I think that's their kind of dig at Microsoft with all their legacy is to say, you know, we don't have all that. Mm. We just got web, like jump on the web. You don't need to think about OneDrive locally syncing and a Word doc that's half in the cloud, half on your computer. We're just on the web. We're simple. You know, we don't have all the fancy stuff. So I think they also know their place in the market and that's what they're serving at the moment. And, you know, at the moment, I think Workspace is a good move. I'm interested to see what it grows into. But as the simpler option gets more complicated, how they're going to manage that? That's where I'm interested.
Yeah, so it's a good good project in or a good case study in project management, in a sense, change management, branding, that sort of thing. So if you're into all of that, then it's definitely worth having a look at for sure. In terms of new products released too, the team were a little bit excited this week. They had the announcement of the new Microbit that's coming out. I haven't had a chance to look at it much, but apparently it's going to do some pretty cool stuff and should keep working with MakeCode and all the different coding platforms that you would use to be able to work with that new Microbit. So it's good to see that low-cost digital technologies kind of equipment is not only just maintaining its space, but it's really starting to take ground. We've definitely seen that in schools. When we first started doing digital technologies in schools a number of years ago, it was all about expensive robotics. It was about spheros. It was about, you know, dancing robots and things like that. And now They're much more looking at integrated technologies around electricity and conductivity, and then adding in all your different bits and pieces. And so to see something like this, even when you start buying add-ons like weather stations and RF senders and all sorts of things like that, it still is very, very cost-effective compared to a lot of other technologies out there, which is pretty good.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people realize you can buy like Wi-Fi microcontrollers for $7-$8. You know, these ESP boards, you might have heard of that, ESP8266 boards, a little Wi-Fi board. And they have all these I/O pins on them, so you can control, you know, soil temperatures and water your garden only when the soil's dry, instead of just guessing. You can, you know, put lights, light meters in, PIR sensors, which detect infrared, like people basically, and turn lights on and off, and, you know, like cost savings. You think about a lot of the environmental things in classrooms. And of course, Stephen Hepple's work, familiar with that, around the environment of the classroom. So how much CO2 is in the room, how much noise is in the room, how much light is in the room. He has a little device that I think costs about $1,000. Whereas you could probably build that with your kids and have little Hepple sensors in all your rooms, checking out, you know, and that's something that actually I'm investing in. We're going to look at for the next 12 months is maybe this is a project the kids could build, start looking at the correlations of hot classrooms or noisy classrooms and how the kids are feeling, you know, doing some surveys and things like that. Low CO2 in classrooms, overly bright, overly dark classrooms. You know, we all have that teacher that turns the projector up too loud and deafens all the kids. You know, those kind of things are interesting. And even, you know, bushfire season as well. Air quality in classrooms, air quality around the school is an interesting one as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw it like an expensive system now that monitors carbon dioxide in the room. And when it hits a certain level, the windows open up. Automation, but I'm sure you could do that with a micro bit and a bit of ingenuity and
just have it make an alarm, like open the window. So I think there's some low tech ways to do this stuff, but it's just about, I think, giving people an application for it, a real application. I've struggled with these micro bits and stuff where you see they go into schools and everyone goes, oh great, we can make LEDs flash, and it's like, okay, and what are we going to do with those flashing LEDs? Well, you know, let's have an application for it, let's do something real with it, not just sort of playing games and mucking around, but feeling like the kids are actually contributing to the school or to something larger than them.
Yeah, definitely. So some good updates coming out. It's been interesting too. You and I were just chatting through some of our planning for 2021 and some of the ways we're thinking about team and so on. So we thought we might just unpack a little bit of some of our thinking around organization charts and so on. And you came across a really good article this week, and we'll link it up in the show notes. But maybe do you want to take us through that article, Blake, and we'll just unpack it a bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically we're just looking at how companies organize themselves. And this article kind of looks at different organizational methods, and it's around the org chart. So I'm looking at my IT team's getting quite large now. We're about to have a second campus. I'm thinking about how we juggle people between roles, how we share roles, how we, you know, what positions we need inside the IT team, like what are the actual structure of it, and also the governance model, like who do we report to, who are we accountable for, what are our consultative bodies. You know, we're at that sort of size now where this stuff really matters. And also, if I can't draw it and I can't put it into words, and this is a challenge I set out for anyone who's in ed tech leadership, is if you can't draw out how things work, how are your staff going to ever know where to go? You know, who's in charge of what? How do I get help? Of course, you know, people would say use the help desk, but I think it's important that you're transparent about, you know, how things work in this school, who you go to, who does what. So, yeah, so we've been really looking at the org chart, and this article that we'll link up kind of spurred my thinking a little bit about going away and trying not to name anything after a product. So they gave the example of Apple. I think when Jobs left Apple, they had people that were in charge of MacBook. They have people who are in charge of iMac. People in charge of, you know, I don't think they had iPhone then, but iPhone is, that's the general idea, is that most companies have pillars of their products, right? Well, the problem becomes with that is if you say, well, I'm going to bring out an iPad, but I've got a guy's in charge of MacBook and a guy's in charge of iPhone, both of those people are going to say, well, I don't like the iPad. We're going to try and kill this product, right? Internally. And so that kind of internal competition actually stifles the company's innovation. And so they're very careful to call it, like, now they have titles that are like head of hardware, head of software, head of cloud services. And so, you know, iCloud isn't like its own top level executive, you know, reporting structure, because if it was, there'd be no way for to bring out the next iCloud, to bring out the next iPhone, or to bring out the next, you know, version of mobile computing. So, you know, the iPad may not have been born if everyone was in those silos. And one of Jobs's instrumental things was going away from any of the products. And so translating this into school terms, and by the way, the article unpacks a lot more, but this is just one of the big things I took away. But translating that into school terms is, often there's someone, the most obvious thing I can think of is someone who's in charge of SharePoint. Mm. So my only job is to administer SharePoint. Now, if you say you're the SharePoint administrator, what's the likelihood that you're going to move to another LMS? What's the likelihood that administrator is going to actually take initiative and innovate? I would say it's pretty low. And the problem is they're locked in. They feel as though, well, okay, if I want to start using this other LMS and I see that it's better, I see that it's easier, my job's not going to be here. But if you put them in charge of learning management systems, then they're free to innovate. They're free to say, well, actually, we're going to start transitioning away from SharePoint. We think this is the future. So it's another little sort of formal structure you can have that can help that breed that culture of innovation, which, of course, is something I'm laser focused on. So, yeah, I thought it was an interesting observation.
Yeah, I wonder if you can take it one step further than that. I'll give you the example or some context to my question. I was on a call this week, with a fairly large organization, and they were talking about adoption of technology. And we had some teachers in the room, and we had the technology team in the room, some of the main leads. And so we get to the point where we're talking about, okay, so what's the next steps? Who do we need to talk to first? Like, who's going to sign off on this? And so you're basically asking them who's going to own the project. And it kind of got caught in the discussion between, is this going to be an IT project because it's technology that's being rolled out, or is it going to be a teaching and learning team project because at the end of the day, it should be impacting the teaching and the learning that's happening. And that stayed unresolved. So at the moment, that project doesn't have a project lead because they still haven't figured out, is it an IT thing or is it a teaching learning thing? And I'm like, surely we can bring these two worlds together in a more integrated way. So that, yes, it still lands on somebody's desk to make the final decision or to get sign off or whatever, but surely we want to look at the outcome rather than the product. In your school, how do you look at that technology? You've got a technology team, but I know you're very integrated in terms of teaching and learning. Can you break that down even further and saying, rather than having a head of LMS, do we have like a head of like learning engagement or, I don't know, reporting or I don't know. What language you would use at your school around that. But I wonder if you could bring those two together somehow.
Yeah, the balance is always, we want to balance the specificity of the role. So something that people can really see and understand and want to apply for, you know, because as well, you're going to advertise these roles. If it's like head of, you know, learning engagement in IT, it's like, well, what is that? What am I doing in that role? You know, I'm not sure what that is. Mm. And so there is so much to naming things. And one of the things that humans haven't figured out is how to name things and categorize things. It's like definitely one of the hardest things that any manager has to deal with is, how do I get a name that represents what I want, but also seems understandable and attractive to someone applying or to the staff who need to understand the name of the role. So it's very challenging. But there is a method that, when you think about org charts, I sort of geek out on org charts a bit. There's sort of three main types of org charts. There's your traditional hierarchical chart, and some people flip that on its side or they have it in the middle going out. But realistically, it's your direct report, right? Who's above you in the org chart? Then you have a separate sort of org chart, which is like a decentralized org chart where you can have tribes. I think, was it Spotify that made this popular? Spotify or Valve, one of those innovative companies, where you have chapters and tribes, and you can be you're a member of a chapter and a tribe, and each of those have a lead, and there's also like a guild. So it's sort of like, you think about like year level and your house. You know, in a school you might belong to a house, but you're also in a year level, but you're also in a form group. So it's sort of giving you that kind of belonging, if you like, and you can figure out where you fit, and that includes you know, all the teams across the whole organization. The problem with that is it doesn't scale up very well into senior management. So you tend to have all this tribe stuff, and then you've just got like hierarchy for senior management, which tends to be a, you know, a property of most businesses. But the third type is interesting because it kind of aligns with what you're talking about, which is that need to have someone in charge of something and you're not really sure where it sits. And so, you know, when you think about a new initiative, there's this idea of a matrix org chart, which is like, think about a spreadsheet. And on every row, you have a project manager, and every column, you have each of those faculties or departments. So you might have like in a business, you might have marketing, you might have R&D, you might have engineering, you might have IT, and then you might have like operations or production or something like that, or retail or something. And then on the rows, you have product managers. And so if a new thing like this comes out, you have a series of product managers, one of them takes on that initiative, and then they go and talk to the learning teams and they go and talk to the IT teams and make it happen. So that's probably what happens in a larger scale. And what I like to think about is how do we take those lessons or those learnings and boil them down into a smaller scale, which is where most schools are that don't have, you know, dedicated product management teams. I don't know any schools that have that. But you can do that in kind of a smaller scale environment where you're able to work across these faculties. So I don't have the answer for that, unfortunately, for you, but it's something to think about. You know, how can you be cross-discipline and kind of slice it horizontally rather than just vertically up and down in a traditional hierarchy sense? Having said that, to answer your question of how we do it, we manage everything as kind of two concepts. We actually have three concepts really, but there's two main concepts. One of those is your position at the school in the IT team. So myself, I'm a systems manager. So I'm in charge of the IT team in the hierarchy. Below me sits the support specialist, the specialist technician, the student tech manager. So the person who looks after the student tech initiative, like that program. And I also look after media and publications. And so those are the positions you can hold. And we only have, you know, one media and publications person, but we have four specialist technicians. Now, those specialist technicians all hold roles, and that's the other concept. So one concept is your position, and the other concept is roles. And roles are specifically technical things. So they're accountabilities, if you like. So you'll be accountable for the network is one, or AV is another one. So I'm not saying, you know, you're accountable for the Cisco wireless controller. I'm not saying you're accountable for the Windows servers. You're just accountable for the data center. And they have their own outcomes. So the data center is all about reliability, uptime, availability, scale. So we have enough room, headroom at all times to add things that we need to add to be really agile. And so, you know, they're the goals we want. We have a sort of a mission, if you like, for each of these roles. And the specialist tech positions are all assigned roles. And the beauty of this is if someone is really strong in one thing, it doesn't mean I have to make a whole new position for that person. I can just switch roles around internally. They're still a specialist technician as a position. And so it's really flexible in a school environment, especially IT. The average lifespan of an IT professional in an organization is 2 years. And so we always have people moving around, wanting to do new things, getting bored with what they're doing, finding new passions, new skills. And we obviously, being a business or an organization that supports innovation, we want them to try new things. So being able to swap roles is really helpful. So we can move people from AV to data center, and also helps us balance roles. One of the things we've found is having someone in charge of network and data center is a really bad idea, because those two often have enormous projects and you have a bottleneck where you can't get projects done in data center because the network projects are taking up all the time. Because they tend to be big infrastructural changes, which take a long time. Whereas if you're in charge of maybe, you know, the printing fleet, there's only a 4-year cycle on the printers, and you know, you're basically just doing maintenance in between. So it helps you sort of balance those roles, the smaller roles, the larger roles, and get a good mix. So the average tech would have 3 or 4 roles in our environment. And even if you only have 2 techs, I think it's worth doing this, because you quickly realize there's like 18 different roles that you're doing as a, you know, quote unquote specialist tech or whatever that you're called in the school. And it's important to identify those and that staff know that, hey, this is what you're doing, because there, I think, unfortunately, there is a sense that techs don't do a lot in schools. We sit around and, you know, we're on Facebook all day or something. No one really quite knows what we're doing. So anything you can do to make that more transparent, I think, has positive benefits as well.
Yeah, and if you're outsourcing your tech, it'd probably be worth having some sort of a mental model around this anyway, right? Because even though maybe you're outsourcing to one person or 2 people, and they're not yours in terms of they're not sitting on your staff, you still have some flexibility around that org chart in the sense of what that would look like. One of the things I'm thinking through, if I was a principal and I was trying to bring through some deputies and, you know, train them up, which is part of the role, I think, of what a good deputy or a, you know, assistant principal should be, is like their development so they can move on and make a great leader at some point, would be to almost take like a scrum model in business where you come together, you knock out a project, and then you dissolve that scrum, which is kind of what that tribe thing does, is they bring people together around a project or an outcome, and they huddle up and they get it done, and then
then like you can subcommittees. You know, we used to have little subcommittees everywhere that would come and do, like when we did interactive whiteboards, we had a subcommittee that looked into them, researched them, figured out the best one, and then when it was delivered, it was done.
Yeah,
I have a few thoughts on that, but keep going.
Yeah. So one of the things I'm thinking through is like if we run in 12-week sprints, so we basically have what we call a 12-week year. And so every week becomes a month, essentially, and you just like zero in on these are the things that we're going to get done. These are the high priorities. Then you bring that team together, you huddle up around it, you knock that project out, and then you dissolve the team, and then you take your next priority. So the complexity around that is when you're looking at pay scales, and you know, obviously an AP or a DP's got a different pay scale to your lead teacher or just a middle manager or something. And what does that look like? But one of the things that maybe rather than saying, okay, well, you're going to be a deputy principal of learning, you just make them a deputy principal full stop, but then they'd take on different roles every term and lead a different project or lead a different group. But then that essentially gets dissolved. So you're not stuck in a silo of here's my expertise and I'm just going to stick in my lane and I'm not going to necessarily have a say or have some influence outside of my role. But really, it's like it almost like it flattens the leadership structure out in the school and everybody's responsible. But you might be leading a particular group or a scrum or a huddle or a project through. So sort of one of those things we've been thinking about as we're leading into doing some, you know, some leadership consultancy with different ways to organize teams in schools for 2021. Just thinking that through. So it lines up quite nicely with that article that you found in sense of take away the role and look more at responsibility in a sense. It gives you that freedom to innovate faster, to switch gears, to not get tied to a particular bandwagon and so on.
Yeah, otherwise you're drilling down on the specifics too much. And that's one thing the freedom of those roles has given our team is if something's not working or someone has this particular weakness or strength, we can play to that. We can take that role and say, look, we need to readjust this. We're giving you, you know, the imaging and the fleet management role, and you know, we're taking away the AV role because it's too hands-on for you, or you're not getting enough work done, or whatever it is. So it lets you dial in your staff a bit better, which is helpful.
Yeah, you could cross-pollinate too, like in the IT team. Maybe you have a teacher who leads one of your teams for a term, just to give you that outside perspective and take it from being an IT project to a teaching and learning project. And maybe they don't have the technical skill, but hopefully they've got the leadership capacity to lean on the people who have got the technical skill to make it happen. So
I guess the challenge with all that is trying to keep it somewhat, simple to digest, like that org chart sort of gets out of control and people aren't sure who's in charge of what. So the challenge you have really, I think, around that is trying to keep it manageable and make it simple enough people can understand who's in charge of what. But just on sprints are, you know, were really popularized maybe 5 years ago with Spotify and these agile scrum type businesses and startups, particularly tech startups. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things that sort of come out of that initial wave of everyone should be doing sprints is output is really high. You get great output, but what you don't get is like good congruity. So you don't necessarily follow ideas through to this final place or their succession. So often things are sort of, a lot of things are half done. And the other issue is support as well during that. So often, you know, we finish and we move to the next thing and it's like, well, hang on, we've still got to support everyone. And they're like, no, I've got no time for that. I'm on the next sprint.
Yeah.
And so, you know, figuring out that structure, whether you separate support and things, which I don't like doing. One of the things with our roles is, and I sort of explained it in the specialist technician position, is that you're responsible for the end-to-end delivery, development, support of that role. So it's not like I put in a project that I leave. And that's what happens in large organizations. Like, you know, departments and regions and districts where a team will put something in, like a new Wi-Fi project, and then the poor people on the ground just have to deal with it, even though it's completely problematic. And so this way, if you put it in, you're dealing with it, you're going to make better decisions next time, you're going to learn a lot more. You're actually going to have to support it, you know, maybe not on the first level, but you're definitely going to have to support the issues that came with your decisions. So that's one thing I'm really passionate about, is tying the decision you make to the outcomes that come from that decision, good and bad.
Yeah, which works if people stick and you don't have churn of staff, I guess, because you've got
turnover,
right? So
of course, but even the short term, you make a decision to change a setting. You know, you have to live with it. The support's going to come to you. If the help desk blows up, it's not someone else's problem. All those tickets end up in your box. So I like that. I think from a management perspective, it takes away a lot of my middle management that I have to do.
Yeah, that's interesting. One of the things we've been talking a lot about is the owner's mindset in the company. And for us, like, if you think like an owner, not like an employee, then you'll find that you'll get that better long-term thinking and more buy-in, I guess. So wherever you sit in that org chart, if you own it, you own the decision, you own the outcome, you own the expense in a sense, the relationship, then I think you're going to get those better long-term results, I think, from that.
Yeah, but you have to actually own it. And that's the thing. A lot of people are called product owners. I know a lot of ed tech companies do this. They say, you're a product owner, you're in charge of this module of our software. But then they're not empowered to make any decisions, right? If you're the product owner, you need to be able to have unilateral say and live and die by your decisions, which is scary for some people, but I think it's really rewarding for most people, is to see that, you know, the decision I made, the mistake I made, or whatever it is, I own it, I fix it, you're going to feel better about it.
Yeah, I can see parallels into the teaching world too. It's almost sometimes a school will put up, or a teacher will put up with something, like a teacher maybe not pulling their weight, maybe not giving 100% until their own kid ends up in that teacher's class, and then all of a sudden that matters, where it should have mattered before. The teaching, you know, what was happening in that classroom should have mattered before, but now that it personally affects you, now you're going to stand up and say something or do something, or, you know, you're going to have an opinion about that. So I think, yeah, coming back to that that concept of, you know, own it as if it's your own, however your org chart is lined up, would make a big difference.
Yeah, and I think teachers do have a large degree of ownership in the classroom, which is sort of something I look at and think, you know, like, if you're a teacher, you feel responsible for those students because you are given that ownership. Like, there's 30 kids in front of you for 45 minutes and they're all looking at you. You can't help but feel that ownership. So you sort of want to mirror that in all roles, not just, you know, the classroom teaching role.
Yeah, totally. It's great. And again, we'll link out that that article in the show notes. It'd be interesting for you guys to have a think about it and see how that might affect you in your role or the way you're thinking about it. And I mean, you can break this down and take learnings from this and even apply it across how you run your teams inside your class with your students, and, you know, have some fun with it in terms of how you organize your students together around projects and around learning outcomes and things like that as well. And one of the things I've always enjoyed as being a teacher is just being able to take some of these principles and apply them to good teaching practice and see what it means and how could I do things differently and just play around the edges a little bit.
And one of the things we're using this for, one of the reasons I restructured is we're taking our student techs a lot more seriously in the next 12 months. And we're actually building them into the structure of the IT team. So they actually sit below and work with the IT team directly. So, you know, there's a group of student technicians, but then they can apply for, like, being the student tech leader or a student tech specialist. They can apply for those positions. And if they get them, then they're actually part of the IT team and they'll have accountabilities and they'll have duties that they have to perform. And they'll have management. They'll have the student tech leader asking them, you know, kids actually managing the process, and obviously all under our eye, but trying to build that, like, real, like, we're talking about job readiness skills is one of the biggest things we have to address. We literally have a working IT faculty department inside the school that operates, you know, a small, medium enterprise in our case. Let's get the kids involved in that. Let's get them seeing different facets of it, but actually get them accountable a little bit as well and feeling what it's like to be working in a job to a degree. Obviously, it's, you know, it's after school and lunchtime every now and again and stuff. So it's not too onerous to take them away from their studies, but it's enough to give them a taste of what working in IT is like. And hopefully at the end of year 12, if they do 6 years of it, you know, they're going to come out as IT professionals ready to engage in the workforce. And in fact, we'll offer them, if they reach a certain level, industry certificates like Cisco CCNAs and Microsoft MCSEs and things like that, to come out of year 12 and be really ready to take on, you know, the next chapter.
So is that all volunteer? Sounds like it's a volunteer role, like a student volunteer.
Yeah, we'll invest in them and get them certificates if they make it through our program. And during them going through that program, they're giving us value by, you know, helping us audit things, helping us roll out labs, helping us, you know, do projects and coordinate things like that. So yeah, it's volunteer. I don't think money changing hands until they're, you know, out of the school hasn't ended well for us. We've had, you know, issues in the past with, you know, paying people to do services who are students, and it's sort of like then they stop doing anything unless they're getting paid. So, I definitely feel like, you know, they're getting so much value out of that when you're at school. If you can leave school and be an IT professional, I think we've done pretty well. And we're having to sacrifice a lot as well in terms of our time and resources. So I think it's a win-win.
Okay. So you're going to run it through like an application process and they have to apply and you've got a certain number and some will make the cut and some won't, or is it going to help?
Yeah. So anyone can join the student technician body by passing a basic training. So they'll come along and it's sort of like a, you know, understanding the mission, the vision, what we're about as an IT team, OHS, safety, all that sort of stuff. As long as they can pass that basic training, they can become part of this body. And then every year we have 12-month positions that are cycled at the end of every year. Where basically the specialist roles, so all those roles I spoke about, like AV and data center, all of those will have a student specialist associated with it, who is like an assistant, if you like, to the IT team who are running those roles. And those assistants can be or will be given duties that they have to perform, you know, throughout the year, basically. And so they'll assist with projects, but they'll also have duties like auditing or chasing things up for people, or, you know, replacing toner and printers, whatever it may be. So big things and small things alike. And then every year they're reassessed, all positions are spilled and new kids get an opportunity. And kids that are doing quite well can keep them. And some kids may do more than one of those roles. And then beyond that is, you know, the higher up the chain is the student tech leader. And so they report to the IT team tech leader, who sort of coordinates the whole program. And they'll run briefings, like everything that I do, basically. They're like a mini version of the IT manager, who'll do a briefing with everyone once a week. They'll follow up and do professional development plans, making sure they're doing certificates. So all of this is backed by a certification process where each of those roles have certificates attached to them. Kids can go do those. They're not huge onerous things, but we build them out and say, these are the skills you need. If you want to help us do imaging, we need you to know how to image. So there's a certificate for that. And the students all self-moderate those, and the student specialists will help actually improve those certificates over time. So that's the ambitious kind of goal. I'm interested to see where we land with it.
Yeah.
But trying to build, like more of a workplace culture around what kids are doing, to give them a real experience of what it's like being an IT professional.
And I'm assuming there'll be kids who would be doing, I don't know what you call it in Victoria, like digital technologies, like a technology certificate as part of their studies, but then there'd be just students who are interested in it as well, right? So.
Absolutely. And students that are like, well, I like tech, maybe I should try it, and then they realize they don't. And we've seen that a lot with our intern program, where we have a support specialist, we call them, and they come in and just do first level support for us on the window, on the phone, all that sort of stuff. And I'd probably say 50% of those think they want to do IT. They come in and work in IT for a year, and then they end up doing psychology, or they see something in there that they think, oh, actually it's a little bit adjacent to IT, but I really like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it'd be better if they could figure that out in year eight than waiting, you know, to work for 12 months. In their case, it's probably pretty good, but going to uni for 4 years or 6 years sometimes, or 8 years, and then realizing, oh, I don't want to do that. It's not ideal.
Yeah. No, that's interesting, because if you tied that back to competencies in lessons, especially I'm just thinking about the guys who are doing technology-based subjects for their VCE. I mean, if you looked at the competencies of what's in those subjects and then tied that to what you're doing, so it's almost like doubling up on their lessons in a sense, you could get some really good gains out of that, I think.
Yep, absolutely. Unfortunately, a lot of what's taught in the IT curriculum is a little dated.
Okay, that's interesting.
don't murder me for saying that, but a lot of the stuff that I see covered in the curriculum in the senior years isn't so applicable to 2020, but a lot of it is as well. There are definitely some core concepts around programming and stuff that could nicely, flow into a lot of our roles.
Hmm. Yeah, that'd be an interesting project just to track through and see how it pans out and how it works.
Yep. Stay tuned for updates.
Yeah, yeah. That's very good. Awesome. Blake, Wheatons and Fails this week. What's caught your attention?
A couple of things. I know some new iPhones are out. Big fanfare, huge event, beautifully produced videos that almost look fake. They're so well produced. You know, it's like that lawn is not a blade out of place in Apple Park over there. Mm. But a bit of a fail for me. All this fanfare, and really we've got same iPhone, maybe a little more expensive, and it's got 5G in it. Like, I'm not, some better video and stuff, but we're really feathering the edges now with phones. I wouldn't be surprised if Apple stopped dropping big keynotes and stuff as well, unless they can really start pushing new stuff into phones, because I feel like, LiDAR, well, that's such a small percentage of the market that's going to be using that. And it's such a transparent, almost invisible thing. Mm-hmm. Back in the days where they were saying, now you can, have a whole awesome camera on your phone, or, we're doing like interesting things with smartphones. I think those days are long gone. So, a bit of a fail for me, these huge, massive events they run, and there really wasn't much there. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that, Mike, the state of Apple and the smartphone?
Yeah, it's almost like they're tied to this innovation cycle where they've got to release, even if they're not ready to release, if that kind of makes sense. Like, you've got a deadline coming, better get something out of the door. Haven't really got anything that's noteworthy, but we feel like we need to do it. It seems to me like they've been stuck in that. And maybe that, again, like we look at incremental change. So you look back over 5 years and you go, wow, things have really changed, but it doesn't seem like it in the moment because it's incremental. It would have been interesting if they had gone, not as many updates and everything's getting cheaper and we're getting better and we found efficiencies in our business model. And so we're actually going to take 25% off the phones and, happy days, everyone go and upgrade right now.
And they know that the appetite for upgrading is a lot less than it was even 2-3 years ago. But they do this with the MacBook line. They just silent launch them. They have a press release, they have a video, and then their website changes. And I feel like that's kind of where they're at now with the iPhone. It's like, yeah, the camera's a bit better. Mm. It's got 5G. Here it is. That's probably all they needed.
I think for the fail for me from that aspect is they're not putting headphones and charger cables in anymore. And so they're saying, oh, we want to save the environment and so on. And good on you if you believe that. But if they really wanted to save the environment, I think they should actually take some steps about it. But for me, it's just like incremental increases in profit at the end of the day, surely.
Maybe. I'd push back on that a little in terms of Apple. Apple's environmental commitments are quite extensive. I've actually read their sustainability report for the last 2 years, and they're developing new forms of aluminium, new ways of processing aluminium. And by the way, this is the only company that has the capital to do this. If they didn't do this, no one would be doing it. So I think there is a lot to be defended, I think, on the side of Apple. They've actually done really good things for sustainability. Their packaging, the way that they stack airplanes, they've thought about every process because they have these goals about carbon neutrality that they have to meet. I'm not saying they're doing amazing. They're not perfect in any sense of the word, but comparative to a lot of other companies who have just got these big broad goals but aren't actually delivering on the small things. I mean, they have the luxury of heaps of profits so they can do this stuff. But I think the good flow and effect is when they perfect these, aluminium production means, then that's going to flow on to the rest of the market. When Lenovo wants to use it, they can use it and have a nice low emissions way of doing it. So, I think Apple are really leading the way with that stuff. And in terms of the headphones, it'll be interesting to see because Australian consumer law requires you to ship headphones with smartphones. So even when they stop doing it in the US, the Pixel, actually, the Google Pixel last, like the model I've got, the Pixel 4 XL, didn't ship with headphones anywhere except in AU and NZ, I think. So that was interesting. I wasn't expecting headphones in the package and they were there because of our consumer law.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. That's interesting. I didn't know that they had to ship headphones with them.
Yeah. But I don't know. Apple have some way of lobbying out of that. Probably they'll just do it and cop the fine or something. I don't know.
I don't know. I think it's a lot of these guys, big companies talk about environmental, and then when you really dig into it, it's not really about the environment. It's about saving money at the end of the day. So they're like, oh, we're going green so we can save ourselves X amount of dollars. But
yeah, I think that's definitely has happened a lot. Yeah. I agree. But in Apple's case, if you actually have a look at their sustainability report, it's pretty interesting. And a lot of experts in the market and the industry will tell you, like, the work they're doing is going to set us up for better production standards and things, because really most of the emissions of an iPhone isn't shipping it. Whilst that is really a lot of emissions, most of it is in production. So if you know, smelting metal is one place we don't have a green renewable way to do it. We have to develop new means of doing it, and there's very few companies in a position to put up the capital to actually investigate and do the R&D on it. So power to them.
Okay. Wins, you've got a resilience of kids in your wins for the day.
Yeah. You know, just coming back to school, with being away such a long time, I think seeing how excited the kids are and seeing the energy that that's, you know, injecting into the staff, it's amazing just to have people around people, like the effect of that. And that's something that's just COVID has really highlighted, I think, is how much human communication matters and human contact matters. And we've certainly seen it from, you know, the kids' perspective, but to then that flow and effect into the staff body of them being super excited. But also, I think there's a lot more gratitude. They feel grateful to be able to come to school now, and it's reframed their going to school from a chore and a drag and a stress point to a, I'm actually excited to be here. Of course, that's going to wear off, but in the short term, I've just been sitting back and enjoying it this week, you know, to see everyone coming back, the energy high, kids really, you know, adopting the safety measures and just being happy to be back. And I think, you know, that just speaks to the volumes to the importance of the teacher again. And it's something we know, but how important that the teacher-student relationships are and the student-student relationships are for kids' development.
Yeah. So it goes from that, I have to go to school, to I get to go to school. It's that frame of mind, right?
Yeah. That gratitude journaling sort of thing. What am I grateful for? You know, I'm grateful to be able to go to school. Well, you probably haven't said that in your whole schooling career up until now. So
no.
It's good.
Yeah. It'll be interesting for our friends in the Northern Hemisphere that are going into winter and lockdowns continue for them, and how that will continue to play out. But yeah, it's definitely reframing how the value of school is not just necessarily about content and skills. It's about relationship, and it's about care, and it's about connection and a whole range of things.
100%.
So, yeah, very interesting. Awesome. I've got a bit of a fun one for you today, Blake. It could be a win. It could be a fail. But I was very interested this week to see our mate Donald Trump get COVID and the whole family got it, and then a couple of days they're well and better, and certainly sparked my interest because I used to work in pathology, so I've got a little bit of a knowledge around bacteria and viruses, and a lot of what I see in the news doesn't sit well with me in terms of how viruses work and vaccines and all of that, and don't really want to get into that on this podcast today anyway, but it's interesting to see someone recover that fast, so that could be a win for the people, or it could be a fail. We'll see how it pays out. Just a shame it wasn't so political, hey?
Very political. But something that's not political is I contracted a sore throat the same day he got sick, and it took me longer to get over my sore throat. So give that what you will.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, definitely interesting. But again, technology is playing a role in all sorts of things. And yeah, it's very interesting. Anything else?
Just on that, the virus side, I was listening to a podcast recently with Eric Schmidt, and he was saying that in terms of careers, future careers, everyone's saying to him, if you're 18 today, where do you work? You know, obviously tech is kind of boomed, and you know, it's now having its day. Where's the new place that's going to have that huge growth? And him and a lot of other experts I'm hearing as well in the tech space are all saying biology. They're saying that the impact of AI, if you compare a computer science degree with biology, those two things are going to be the skeleton key, if you like, for unlocking huge potentials in how we do medicine, how we do, you know, patient care, and also how we treat and cure diseases and everything else, because the AI will be able to approximate things that a microscope can't physically see anymore. It can go even deeper and deeper and figure out those, you know, those core units, if you like. And the impact of that, he said, is going to be astronomical. We're going to be able to change the course of the genome to, you know, map the genome properly. You know, I'm not an expert in it, but it's just what I'm hearing a lot more is, you know, where's the new tech space? Where's that new growth market? It's pairing AI and tech skills with biology.
Mm. Yeah, definitely healthcare has been the focus of a lot of the conferences that we go to when we go to a Microsoft and a Google conference, especially in the business space, not the education space, obviously, but
it's coming.
Yeah,
it
those
be ahead of this stuff.
They're pushing cloud and medical very hard, and have probably for the last 3 years, a lot of their case studies and a lot of the big gains they've been making has all been in that medical space. And they're definitely asking for specialization to be able to go into those medical verticals for sure. But they definitely see that as a place to go. So there you go. There's a tip of the day. If you're looking for a transition in your career, or you're looking to give some ideas to your kids about where they should be focusing their energy, sciences, medicine, technology, you've got it covered.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thanks, Mike. It's been a great conversation as always. Digging into those org charts, I geek out on that all day. But if anyone wants me to share that as well, hit me up on Twitter at Blake Seifert. Happy to share how we break our roles down, how I do my positional structure, and you know, our governance model and everything. So more than happy to share that stuff.
Yeah, that's a great offer as well. We'll catch you in the next episode. Thanks for joining us on episode 25, our quarter of a century. And we'll see you next week with another great episode to come your way.
Thanks for listening. For more episodes and show notes, visit utb.fyi/outclassed.